Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. So social media censorship is everywhere today. Both it happening and the discussion of it is becoming very mainstream. But obviously there's context around it. On one side, it's about censoring ideas they don't agree with, which is clearly what's happening. On the other side, it's about fake news and combating Russian divisiveness in the American people. Either way we look at it, we can clearly see that social media censorship and censorship in general is now has now worked its way into being a normal thing. Just, you know, depending on what side you're on, it still doesn't matter. It's happening today. Whereas one point it was a conspiracy theory. Today, this video I put up, no image, no title, just basically the Daily Wrap-Up, 8-8, no links in the show notes. And before I even hit schedule, it was demonetized and restricted. And this is nothing new. I know many of you don't even like to hear this over and over because we know it's happening. But we have to recognize that they are, and my channel is not that large. The Last American Vagabond is on the lower end of the larger thing that is the independent media. But I'd like to think we're growing. But regardless, it's about content. It's about the topics that we're discussing and the manner in which we're discussing them. And clearly, this is not about censoring tags or titles or content, because YouTube could have no possible way of knowing what I was going to talk about today. They're censoring people. They're censoring channels because they know the kind of things we talk about, which tends to be what we think is the truth. And rather in a way that's critical of the establishment narrative, but applying critical thought and rational, open-minded views on all the things we're talking about and challenging the establishment narrative. And I truly think it has mostly to do with what's going on overseas, being carried out in our names, U.S. foreign policy, as everything they seem to be doing here is another way of pitting us against each other and distracting us from the larger agenda that's taking place. And that doesn't mean domestic policy is not important. It's quite the opposite. It's very important. Almost more so, I mean, equally so as everything else. But what's going on overseas today is very, very important as it's being done in our name. And it is continuing to influence the rest of the world in regard to Americans. Not just the current oligarchy that's hijacked our government, but Americans. Whether or not we agree with what they're accomplishing. So I just want people to recognize this. And it's more important than ever that you go out and support your independent media. Be that myself or any number of the sites and channels that I look at and discuss, or that you understand is in your own right that you believe in and you think is at least using critical thought in regard to their coverage. Support them on Patreon, support them on PayPal, just share their videos, but get out there and support independent media and start taking a stance in regard to all this stuff. Start using BitChute and Steemit and DTube and things that are outside their control. Never been more important than today. Now, one of the first things I want to discuss, and clearly what I think is one of the largest things being censored right now, is in regard to Iran. And the first article coming from Caitlin Johnstone, actually from Medium.com, entitled, "That Time Trump's Iran Advisor Threatened to Murder an Official's Children to Start the Iraq War." Sounds pretty inflammatory, but guess what? It's completely factually correct, and something he himself does not even disagree with. Pretty important. But you're not going to hear that on the mainstream media. And these are the kind of things that this is why independent media is being censored today. It's not about left or right. It's not about the two-party deception. It's about anti-establishment, anti-war, critically thinking narratives, discussion points, every single time. And there are plenty of other people being censored that I think is part of kind of a deception as well. But that's all up for you to decide. Ultimately, the point is to continue to support your independent media, just like this. This is an important story to cover today. Now, Bolton has been ramping up his TV appearances to assure the public that Iran is evil and the U.S. is good, and that recent reimposed sanctions are also in the best interest of spreading democracy, and that the protests happening are, and about to happen, of course, because they know, are of course a completely organic uprising from an oppressed people that have nothing to do with the U.S. desire to take control of the Iranian government, demonstrably so for decades now. And to absurdly say that, no, we're not seeking regime change in Iran. Of course not. Of course that's not what we're trying to accomplish. But in that note, I've actually made a montage that I shared earlier, and I'm going to share again at the end of this video, which I won't forget. But check this out, because these are the very people currently saying that they're not seeking regime change in Iran.
We should provide material financial support to the opposition if they desire it. We should work with intelligence services from other countries, Saudi, Israel, to provide more pressure. There's a lot we can do, and we should do it. Our goal should be regime change in Iran.
The declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran. The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
The MEK is a significant movement in Iran, and not just the MEK, but other similar kinds of organizations opposed to the regime. Now, there is no organization as comprehensive as the MEK, or with the both internal and foreign, and where we would constitute the foreign support. You've been able to form resistance units all over Iran. Those protests are not happening accidentally. Those protests are happening because they're being coordinated now. They're being coordinated by many of our people in Albania and many of our people here and all throughout the world. And I want to tell you, the changes in Washington are very exciting. You saw on this stage, standing here, of course in Paris, but this reminds me of Paris, you saw John Bolton. You remember John Bolton. He's going to be President Trump's national security advisor. You think he changed his mind? No, in fact, if anything, John Bolton has become more determined that there needs to be regime change in Iran, that the nuclear agreement needs to be burned, and that you need to be in charge of that country. The right policy for Iran, for every good, decent government in the world, is regime change. Regime change. You. Regime change. Regime change. Absolutely. Let him hear it. Let him hear it in Tehran.
Now, in each one of those instances, those are, in fact, the people viewing and around them, for the most part, are the MEK, which is a verifiable terrorist organization that was very recently on the United States government terrorist watch list until, in fact, Hillary Clinton took them off. But verifiably have killed Americans in the past by our own admission. And these are the groups that they're speaking to. We can hear these very same people, an article that just came out yesterday, I believe, in Politico, where John Bolton was saying, no, we're not seeking regime change in Iran. Seems very different to what they were preaching to the MEK, who is their plan to instill in, to reinstall in Iran once they pull out the other government, which is classic U.S. policy abroad, is what they've been doing for decades. And we can see very clearly by their own admission that not only are they the foreign support for this group doing this, but that they, by Rudy Giuliani's own words, that they have created the protests that are taking place. That they are the people that are making this a coordinated effort. It's all right there. There's no way to misunderstand this information. And that's why it's so important to do your due diligence here and recognize what's really going on. As Caitlin says in her article, that these are the kind of people that are controlling U.S. foreign policy, and specifically in regard to John Bolton, like the title says. She writes, since we're seeing so much John Bolton and so much talk of terrorists, I think this would be a good opportunity to remind everyone of the time that John Bolton threatened to murder the children of an OPCW official in order to deceive the world into consenting to the Iraq War, which killed a million people. Jose Bustani was the director general of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in early 2002, during which the Intercept report came under fire for having too much success in diplomacy with the Iraqi government, which undermined the case for the invasion. So Bolton attempted to scare him off. From the Intercept, quote, Cheney wants you out. Bustani recalled Bolton saying, referring to the then vice president of the United States, we can't accept your management style. Bolton continued, according to Bustani's recollections, you have 24 hours to leave the organization. And if you don't comply with this decision by Washington, we have ways to retaliate against you. That in and of itself is pretty horrifying for someone to do. Then, as it goes on, it says there was a pause, and Bolton says, "We know where your kids live. You have two sons in New York." And Bolton declined to comment on this story, never even saying it wasn't true, instead referencing something else that was completely unrelated. This is the person controlling almost completely U.S. foreign policy today. That's an excellent thing to understand. This is the kind of stuff that you will not hear anywhere else, and why these videos get demonetized and why these things are not allowed to spread. The video we did just yesterday is one of the lowest view counts that I've ever seen on this channel, despite generally the same amount of comments and upvotes. These are things they don't want you seeing, because these are the people, the elite oligarchy controlling this country, do not want this kind of content to get out. Stuff that is not a part of the two-party paradigm, but it's simply truth about their real intentions about what's going on in the world and the ways in which they will go to great lengths to make it happen, including threatening the children of somebody in the OPCW. Pretty horrendous. Moving on to the next story coming from ZeroHedge.com, entitled, "Senate Democrats are circulating plans for government takeover of the internet." Now, first of all, the title says Senate Democrats, and it's always important not to make anything we're talking about here about the two-party paradigm, and that's not what this is meant to be in my mind. The reason I want to talk about this is simply because it gives you an insight, whether this even comes to pass or not, that government today, not just social media platforms with their agendas, but actually Congress, is considering ways in which to legally stifle the internet. And that should scare all of us more than just about anything else today, because it will take away one of our last refuges today of being able to communicate and share our ideas. I mean, even if they can make this kind of thing happen, it could effectively find ways to censor more than just platforms, but the internet in general. And that's very horrifying. So a leaked memo circulating among Senate Democrats contains a host of authoritarian proposals for regulating digital platforms, purportedly as a way to get tough on Russian bots and fake news, of course, to save America's trust in our institutions, democracy, free press, and markets. The proposal suggests we need unprecedented and undemocratic government intervention into online press and markets, including comprehensive data protection legislation of the sort enacted in the EU. Titled, quote, "Potential Policy Proposals for Regulation of Social Media and Technology Firms." The draft policy paper, penned by Senator Mark Warner and leaked by an unknown source, of course, to Axios, yet again showing how absurdly loose these people are, that this information just leaks everywhere today, and it's clearly not by accident. These things are leaked intentionally. That's the way of American politics today. The paper starts out by noting that Russians have long spread disinformation, including when, quote, "the Soviets tried to spread fake news, denigrating Martin Luther King." And here he fails to mention that the Americans in charge at that time actually did the very same thing. But now it's different because technology. Goes on to quote, "Today's tools seem almost built for Russian disinformation techniques." That's what he says. And ones to come, he assures us, will be even worse. Based on complete hypotheticals, there's no verifiable proof to show that there's been anything essentially trying to spread disinformation. We can show verifiable proof that some Russian entity purchased Facebook ads, but there's no verifiable connection to the government. Everyone in the world uses Facebook today. And even that being said, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that that had any influence whatsoever on the election. And again, even if it did, my point I always make is that everybody, in particular the United States government, is actively trying to influence everything around the world, especially the United States. So it's wildly hypocritical to say this. But as of yet, there's no proof even to suggest this even happened. It goes on to say, here's how Warner is suggesting we deal. Mandatory location verification. The paper suggests forcing social media platforms to authenticate and disclose the geographic origin of all users or posts. Mandatory identity verification. The paper suggests forcing social media and tech platforms to authenticate user identities and only allow authentic accounts. Obviously, right, they would be able to decide what's an authentic account. Once again, putting it into a subjective, biased opinion maker to make a choice on what's authentic and what's not. Bot labeling. Warner's paper suggests forcing companies to somehow label bots or be penalized, with no word on him how this is even remotely feasible. Define popular tech as essential facilities. These would be subject to all sorts of heightened rules and controls, says the paper, offering Google Maps as an example of the kinds of apps or platforms that might count. Quote, the law would not mandate that a dominant provider offer the service for free. Rather, it would be required to offer it to on a reasonable and non-indiscriminatory terms provided by the government. Of course, provided by the government. All of this coming back to the ultimate point that, as always, these things are ambiguous to some degree, which can then be manipulated by those in control of it and use it to benefit themselves, individuals in the government. This is talking about ultimately one more step in controlling the narrative. This is a horrifying step. And it's not just Democrats, but this is what this article was about. The point to take away is that there are people in Congress right now discussing ways to further control our discussion. And that should scare us all. Moving on to the next story coming from theantimedia.com entitled WikiLeaks, U.S. Senate asks Julian Assange to testify about Russia. Big step in this story. And I'm going to continue to cover this as it moves forward. Now, as always, regardless of your opinion of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in general, this story is very relevant to the future of journalism in this country and free speech. So regardless of your opinion, this is an important story to cover. Julian Assange has been asked to testify before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee as part of their Russian investigation, according to a letter signed by Senators Richard Burr and Mark Warner, posted by the official WikiLeaks Twitter account. The letter, delivered to Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, reads in part, quote, as part of the inquiry, the committee requests that you make yourself available for a closed interview, which I find interesting, with bipartisan committee staff at a mutually agreeable time and location. WikiLeaks says their legal team is, quote, considering the offer, but testimony must conform to a high ethical standard. After which the whistleblower organization added a tweet linking to a list of 10 Democratic senators who demanded in late June that Assange's asylum be revoked in violation of international law. So clearly he's saying, look, you guys have no desire to actually do what's right here and actually follow the law. You simply, I think, want to suss me out. That's what I'm feeling from this. And so he's trying to make sure that he has something probably written. But even then, I'm very wary of where this is going. Late August, Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, I believe is how you say your name, traveled to London with journalist Charles Johnson for a meeting with Assange, after which Rohrabacher said the WikiLeaks founder offered, quote, firsthand information, providing that the Trump campaign did not collude with Russia, and which would refute the Russian hacking theory. After Trump denied knowledge of the potential deal, Rohrabacher raged at Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, for constructing a, quote, wall around President Trump by people who do not want to expose this fraud, which is an interesting way to look at that, in the concept that they're, in a way, insulating him from even knowing about this taking place, which I find kind of hard to believe. Again, this kind of tries this idea that Trump is being, that, you know, Trump is the secret solution in a wall of the deep state manipulating him. And I don't feel that is the case. You could make the argument that maybe he's unaware of how he's being corralled, but clearly in general, everything going forward in foreign policy is the opposite of what we would think is the right thing to be taking place today. So I don't think Trump is the part of the solution at all, as far as I'm concerned, but I'm open to that possibility. Doesn't seem like that's the case, however. And in January of 2017, Julian Assange's legal team approached Clinton-linked DC lobbyist Adam Waldman to reach out and see if anyone in the Trump administration would negotiate with WikiLeaks founder, only, of course, to have James Comey himself kill the deal. So the way this has all progressed, this very much feels like a trick to me. That's my personal opinion, my gut instinct, a way to kind of make him the scapegoat here. And I wonder if he will even be willing to divulge who his source is, if that's obviously the kind of the way out in a way. If he's testifying, the only way for him to make this happen would be to divulge who his actual source was, which we know was not Russia. And even now that he has been murdered, which I'm, of course, talking about Seth Rich, I would feel like simply out of principle, Julian Assange might not want to divulge that, which he said in the past. And that could be used against him to make it seem like he's somehow protecting Russia, even though we know that's not the case. And I'm going to use this moment to play the video that I've played in the past that shows very clearly, if you're not blind to what's really being said here, that we know very clearly that Seth Rich was the source in regard to the DNC leaks, which is what's this all revolving around.
The stuff that you're sitting on, is an October surprise in there? Do you even know what you're sitting on?
WikiLeaks never sits on material. whistleblowers go to significant efforts to get us material and often very significant risks. As a 27-year-old who works for the DNC, who was shot in the back, murdered just 2 weeks ago for unknown reasons as he was walking down the street in Washington. So
that was just a robbery, I believe, wasn't it?
No, there's no finding. So
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that our sources take risks, and they become concerned to see things occurring like that.
But was he one of your sources then? I mean,
we don't comment on who our sources
are. But why make the suggestion about a young guy being shot in the streets of Washington?
Because we have to understand how high the stakes are in the United States, and that our sources are, you know, our sources face serious risks. That's why they come to us, so we can protect their anonymity.
But it's quite something to suggest a murder. So, that's basically what you're doing.
Well, that others have suggested that. We are investigating to understand what happened in that situation with Seth Rich. I think it is a concerning situation. There's not a conclusion yet. We wouldn't be willing to state a conclusion, but we are concerned about it. And more importantly, a variety of WikiLeaks sources are concerned when that kind of thing happens.
So you can see there very clearly, that little end clip was part of the video that I have on there, but you can see very clearly here that there's no way to misunderstand what he says there. Again, and people have said in the chat, you know, there's a lot of reasons to doubt WikiLeaks or Assange in general. That's up for everyone to decide for themselves. At the end of the day, this story, regardless of how the reality behind it, where it's going and how it's being used, is important to each one of us. Anyone that's online trying to spread truth and believes in freedom of press and freedom of speech, it's an important story. But in regard to what he's saying there, he very clearly insinuates, basically says outright, that the person who was shot in Washington, D.C. on that very same night is in fact his source. So my question would be, if they actually get him in front of Congress here, this committee rather, would he be willing to divulge who his actual source was, which would be the real way to show that it wasn't the people that they're making it out to be? Very interesting development. I feel like this is somewhat of a trap, kind of a way to suss him out of the Ecuadorian embassy so he can then be extradited. We'll have to wait and see what happens. But as always, keep track of the story, because I do believe, regardless of your thoughts on WikiLeaks, that it's a very relevant story. I do find it to be very important. Moving on to the next story, and this is a very, very hard one yet again to digest, but I do think it's truly important. In a way, it's kind of bittersweet, because these people are actually being held accountable to a large degree, more than we've seen in the past. Entitled, Cop and State Attorney Jailed After Fellow Cops Caught Them Raping a Baby and Filming It. Horrible title. And it's a true story, and it's a horrible, horrible case. But the reality is they are actually being held accountable for a lot of time in jail. But there's still a point to be made here, and I'll come back to that in a second. So a police officer has been sentenced to 16 years in prison. Which is good to see that these people are actually getting more than some months or a year in jail for pedophilia and rape, which is what's been happening to date. 16 years in prison after he was caught by a fellow officers raping an infant, which is just absolutely horrible. The now former cop, 48-year-old Dean Roberts, filmed himself abusing a helpless infant while on duty. He then distributed the footage to other pedophiles in a messaging app. After he was arrested, it was discovered that he had been plotting with other pedophiles to jointly abuse other children to make and distribute more footage. After his arrest, this vile police officer admitted to rape, sexual assault of a child, possessing and distributing indecent images of children. What's more, Robert's partner in crime was John Guess, who happens to be a state attorney who worked for the Welsh government as a legal advisor. Very clearly showing some systemic problem here. At the very least, between them both. Guess was sentenced to 26 years in prison earlier this month after he was caught abusing two other young girls. According to the court, Guess was also caught taking photos of children as they got changing at swimming pools, which is just, I mean, these people have a very clear problem here. And that 26 years, I still don't even think is enough, in my opinion. As many would no doubt use the go-to excuse, as always, of bad apples, to ignore the obvious systemic issue this appears to demonstrate. As the author notes, sadly, as tragic as this case is, it is not an isolated incident. In 2016, a study exposed the startling fact that police officers are arrested about 1,100 times a year, or roughly 3 officers charged every day. Many of these arrests are over unspeakable sex crimes. According to lead researcher Philip M. Stinson, quote, our data directly contradicts some of the prevailing assumptions and the proposition that only a small group of rotten apples perpetrate the vast majority of police crime. In cases involving allegations of sexual abuse, 72% of the officers were fired, which is good, but not charged. But then more 80% resulted in convictions, the study found. There were 422 reports of cases of forcible and statutory rape, 352 cases of forcible fondling, and 94 sodomy cases over 7 years of the study, which Stinson called, quote, larger than expected based on the existing research. The data search turned up 174 examples of male officers arrested in cases of, quote, driving while female, in which women drivers were harassed or assaulted. About 82% of those cases ended in convictions. The probe revealed that 550 officers were decertified for various sexual assaults, including rape. Some of these dismissed for sodomy or sexual shakedowns, where victims were forced to perform sexual acts to avoid arrest. A further 440 officers lost their jobs for other sex-related offenses, such as possessing child pornography, being a peeping Tom, sending sexually charged messages to underage teens, or having sex while on duty. About one-third of the officers lost their jobs, one-third, for committing sexual offenses with juveniles. One-third of the officers lost their job for committing sexual offenses with juveniles. Another independent study found that sexual misconduct is the second highest of all complaints nationwide against police officers, representing 9.3% in 2010, according to a study by the Cato Institute's National Police Misconduct Reporting Project. In 2010, 354 of the 618 complaints involved non-consensual sexual acts, and over half of those involved were minors. Very, very shocking statistics. Now, the real takeaway here, clearly these people, to a large degree, are being held accountable, which is good. But we also find out that they don't really serve as much time as we would like to imagine, while we see someone like Ross Ulbricht serving a double life sentence for a nonviolent crime. Yet these ones we're talking about today did get 16 and 26 years, which is fantastic. But still, there's a discrepancy there for somebody committing a rape of a child and pedophilia and solicitation of child pornography getting 16 years, while Ross Ulbricht is serving double life sentence for a nonviolent crime. Still, but nonetheless, I still think it's a positive thing they're getting more than they have in the past, but there's still a problem here. But again, the real takeaway is that it's not just bad apples. There is a systemic problem, both in politics and law enforcement, with exactly this kind of act. And nobody wants to acknowledge that, but the statistics are all there. So come to your own conclusions, as always, but feel free to dive into this because it's something that needs to get more attention. Moving on to the final story of the day, coming from MiddleEastEye.com, and I find to be a very important story that, again, doesn't get covered because it relates to Israel in regard to actual Israeli people who stand against what's being done there, entitled, resigned, essentially, a Israeli government member, a politician, resigns because of the Jewish nation state law, calling it ethnic cleansing. I think that's very important. But of course, you're not going to see this anywhere else, except I would imagine independent media, I would hope. So a Knesset member, the group, who resigned in protest over the Jewish nation state law, says the legislation, quote, normalizes and enshrines in law the superiority of Israeli Jews over their Arab peers. Interesting, and warned of a limit to what the Arab community in Israel will tolerate. Very interesting to see an Israeli politician taking this stance. Zuhair Bilol, 67 years old, a popular sports commentator turned politician who represented the Zionist Union, quit the Knesset on 28th of July following the passage of the law last month, which declared Israel to be the nation state of the Jewish people, effectively passing into law, literally, that it's an apartheid state. In an interview with Middle East Eye, Bilal said that after 3 years in parliament, he was moved to quit over a law he says institutionalizes the, quote, inferior status long experienced by Arab citizens of Israel. Quote, my resignation is an outcry that we will not accept laws that chase the Arab presence from this country. That's very profound. An Israeli politician speaking out against it. It just goes to show you all these people trying to push that it's some kind of all-encompassing Jewish problem are simply ignorant of what's really going on. Clearly, there is a problem there, as I continue to document. The government itself, the Zionist control, but clearly there's people within, Jewish people included, Israeli people included, that very clearly see the problem with all of this. The real problem, or in addition to that other problem, one of the other real problems, is that the Western media refuses to cover the reality of this situation. For political reasons, or for many other reasons we could get into. There's a lot going on here. But the reality is they are keeping this information from the American people and from the Western world in general because it contradicts their agenda, which is a horrible thing to realize of so-called journalists. Not very impartial, as they like to say. It's pretty horrifying to see this stuff, all these stories today. It really gives you an insight into what's really going on in the world that you will not see on even a lot of independent channels today. We have to recognize what's really going on in this country specifically as an American, as Americans, those out there, Americans that are watching this channel, as well as those around the world. We have to recognize the oligarchy currently controlling the U.S. has clearly chosen to stand with the worst the world has to offer. The very civilian murdering, human rights trampling, sinister world dominating, genocide committing governments that they pretend to be fighting, when in reality they are living a living example of the classic propaganda saying, accuse your enemies of that which you are guilty. And it only takes the smallest amount of due diligence to see that our supposed leaders are actually doing the very same things as these ill-intentioned allies. And despite the claims from these documented U.S. liars, they are seeking to create the same in Iran, while ignoring far worse from those with U.S. support. So I leave you again with some clear evidence of what they truly want and how they're making it happen. And for those who want to continue this conversation, stay tuned on this page and for the T-Lab research and review that will begin following this show. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
We should provide material financial support to the opposition if they desire it. We should work with intelligence services from other countries, okay. Saudi, Israel, to provide more pressure. There's a lot we can do, and we should do it. Our goal should be regime change in Iran.
The declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran. The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
The MEK is a significant movement in Iran, and not just the MEK, but other similar kinds of organizations opposed to the regime. Now, there is no organization as comprehensive as the MEK, or with the both internal and foreign, and where we would constitute the foreign support. You've been able to form resistance units all over Iran. Those protests are not happening accidentally. Those protests are happening because they're being coordinated now. They're being coordinated by many of our people in Albania, and many of our people here, and all throughout the world. And I want to tell you, the changes in Washington are very exciting. You saw on this stage, standing here, of
of course, in Paris, but this reminds me of Paris, you saw John Bolton. You remember John Bolton. He's going to be President Trump's national security advisor. You think he changed his mind? No, in fact, if anything, John Bolton has become more determined that there needs to be regime change in Iran, that the nuclear agreement needs to be burned, and that you need to be in charge of that country. The right policy for Iran, for every good, decent government in the world, is regime change. Regime change. Regime change, absolutely. Let him hear it. Let him hear it in Tehran. You know they're nervous. You know they're frightened.